Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Thanks very much for joining me, and welcome to the show. I just had a great time, and you'll hear this, you'll hear evidence of the great time being had, talking with Min-Soo Kang about his recent translation of The Story of Hong Gil-dong. This came out in 2016 with Penguin Classics. Now, this is a really cool and really important book to come out, and it's an important book, I think, for listeners to know about, not only because it is a new translation of, again, what you'll hear me say in a moment, is arguably the single most important work of classic prose fiction of Korea, and that's in the words of the book. It's such a pleasure to read. It's also going to be a resource that's really, really useful to teach with. So those of you who are listening who like a good story, this is a kind of, it's been described as a kind of Robin Hood figure for Korean literature, who are interested in learning more about Korean literature, but also who are interested in having more really great, readable in a week, affordable, fascinating primary sources to teach with in all kinds of undergraduate and graduate courses, this is really a book worth checking out and worth knowing about. So it's an extensive interview, so I'll let you get right to it. But I'll just say, I hope you enjoy. Thanks very, very much, as ever, for listening and for your support of the channel. And happy reading when you do get your hands on it, and happy listening for now. I'm here today to talk with Min-Soo Kang about his really great new translation of The Story of Hong Gil-dong. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Min-Soo, and thanks not just for making time to talk with me today and dealing with the time difference, but also for translating an awesome, super fun, super assignable, and super great book. Welcome to the channel, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is great. And thanks for the compliment. I'm really glad that this work of classical Korean fiction will become better known to English readers.
Great. So, Min-Soo, we've actually had a chance to talk before for a different podcast, for the New Books in STS podcast about your previous book. But for listeners who haven't had a chance to listen to that one, let's start by talking a little bit about what you're working on when you're not translating The Story of Hong Gil-dong. So can you say a little bit about kind of what your research area is right now and what you're currently working on when you're not translating?
Sure. So I guess I could say that my day job is as a intellectual historian of Europe in the 18th and 19th century, specializing in intellectual and cultural history of Western Europe. And much of my previous research have been done on the history of automata. In my last book, The Sublime Dreams of Living Machines, was on the history of automaton and how it was utilized as a intellectual symbol throughout the centuries, and from the narrow time period from ancient Greece to the 1930s. So that's an area still that I'm doing a great deal of research for and planning out sort of next couple of books on. And also I write fiction. I've written a book of short stories called Of Tales and Enigmas. And working on a novel right now, and especially gotten interested in science fiction versus fantasy, not science fiction and fantasy, but science fiction versus fantasy. I've written an essay recently on a volume that's going to come out on medieval science fiction about the way in which science fiction versus the fantasy genre looks at the European Middle Ages and how that's different and so on. And that's one of the areas that I'm interested in at the moment.
Very cool. And if we have time later, I'm going to want to hear all about how you managed to find the time to do all of these fabulous things.
Yes.
And sleep and eat and teach. But in the meantime, we'll just kind of leave it there and bask in the awesomeness of all of these things that you're doing. So the book that we are here to talk about today is a translation of The Story of Hong Gil-dong, which the book calls arguably the single most important work of classic prose fiction of Korea. So this is a big deal. This is a really important work to translate. Let's kind of talk a little bit about how you came to this particular project. Why was it important for you to translate this work, and what drew you to this project and also made it feel like a project that, you know, you wanted to commit this much of your resources to?
Yeah. So for anybody who had a childhood in Korea, Hong Il-dong is inescapable. He's part of the culture. He's, and, you know, and as I pointed out, in the introduction, the extent of his fame is that the name Hong Il-dong is used as like a placeholder name, like John Doe, so that like if people show you a form, how to fill out a form, and the place where you're supposed to put your name, it says Hong Il-dong on it, right? I've been to funeral parlors in Korea where they show different tombstones, and all of them had Hong Il-dong where the name is supposed to go.
Wow.
Yeah. And in America, the simplest way to check this out is if you go to the Wikipedia article on Korean names. As an example of a typical Korean name, they will show Hong Il-dong in both the Korean Hangul letters as well as in Chinese characters. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like that. This is a, like a typical Korean name, right? And also the image of animated Hong Il-dong, that's everywhere. So I was asked a couple of times about, you know, when was the first time you encountered Hong Il-dong? And I'm like, that's an impossible question to answer, because that's like asking an American, when was the first time you encountered Superman or Mickey Mouse?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so part of the culture, right? I mean, that's just what you grow up with. But to give you a more specific answer, when I was an undergrad, I took a class on Introduction to Cultural History. And one of the books that we read for that class was Eric Hobsbawm's book, Bandits. And, you know, of course, Eric Hobsbawm is most famous for his pioneering work on European nationalism. But this slim book just really had an enormous influence on me, because, well, first of all, he asks this question. I mean, human beings, we come together, we build civilization, we come out with a set of laws, because obviously that's preferable to living in a state of anarchy or, you know, Hobbesian state of nature. But if civilization is something that we as human beings inherently desire, why is it that so many of our heroes and celebrated figures are outlaws?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's completely understandable why we would laud, upholders of civilization and upholders of law. But, you know, we are as fascinated with outlaws to the extent of making heroes out of them, right? And, you know, this is one of those books where I go, you know, that's a really good question. And in order to answer that question, Hobsbawm points to a number of different character types, you know, that are celebrated outlaws, among which is the figure of the noble robber. And he gives a bunch of different characteristics of what a typical noble robber is, including his career as an outlaw begins from an injustice he or people around him suffers. He takes from the rich and gives to the poor. The only time he kills is in self-defense or in defense of, you know, innocent people. And there's also the interesting conservative element, which is that with these noble robber types, they are never against the highest authority of the land, but against local oppressors. Hmm. Right. So for instance, Robin Hood is not against King Richard. He's against the Sheriff of Nottingham, who is abusing the power given to him by higher authorities. Right. But anyway, I mean, so you look at this and obviously for, you know, most Western, you know, Westerners, the immediate figure is obviously Robin Hood. But Hobsbawm's book was extraordinary because he shows that you can find that person like anywhere in the world. I mean, there's a West African Robin Hood. There's a Chinese Robin Hood. There's a, you know, Eastern European Robin Hood. It's like you take those descriptions of the noble robber and you could probably go to any place in the world and a local person would say, oh, yeah, we have one of those. Right? And for me, I immediately thought, this is Hong Gyo-dong, right? I mean, Hong Gyo-dong is not mentioned in the Hobsbawm book, but that's just immediately what I thought of. So I ended up writing my final paper for that class on Hong Gyo-dong and applying Hobsbawm's ideas to him. And at that time, there was a translation of the story of Hong Gyo-dong that was made in the 1960s by Marshall Pill. And I felt that the translation was a little bit odd. I mean, it felt truncated. I mean, there were plot points that was never resolved, and it felt a little bit. I thought that there were stories in there. There were stories that were supposed to be in there. There wasn't. And later on, what I found out was that there's no less than 34 different existing manuscripts of the story of Hong Gyo-dong. And they're all of different length. And the translation that was made in the 60s was one of the shortest variants among all its different things. For reasons that I might get into later, the shorter versions are seen. Scholars have pointed out the shorter versions are the later versions, that if you want to get to the version that is either the Ur text or the one that's closest to it, you got to look at the longest version. So the longest version, the Pilsar 89, is like five times the length of the shortest versions that is in existence. So, based upon my research, I thought it would be the best idea to tackle the translation of the longest version, which is what I did. After that class, I went on to grad school, and for various personal reasons, I decided to go into European history. Since then, I've always said that, okay, one day I'm going to revisit this. One day I'm going to get back to Hong Gyo-dong and do some research and do an updated new translation, probably after I get tenure. And that's exactly what happened. I got a tenure track job, wrote my tenure book, got tenure, and I had some time, to decide what to do next. And I revisited, and I thought, I thought this was going to be a short project, right? Because I thought that there was going to be, I was going to do some research on these different variant manuscripts, and it was going to be a similar length. But then when I started doing actual historical research on, the history of the story and the history of the manuscript, it felt like I stepped on a scholar's minefield, because there were extremely complicated issues that has to do with the origin of the story, the controversies and the debates about, who wrote it and when, and again, which variant is the is the oldest one, and so on. What I found extraordinary was that, as difficult as it was for me to hash through all of these difficult issues, and also, getting through the pre-modern Korean was a huge challenge for me.
Kind of language, right?
Exactly. I mean, I've done some translation of modern Korean works, it's like there's a great divide when modern literature begins in East Asia, because starting in the very late 19th and early 20th century, there's a whole generation of Korean writers who studied modern literature in Japan, learning from Japanese literature or Japanese translations of Western literature and applying the same kind of craft to Korean literature. And it's a world away from anything that existed before that. So I really had to put myself in a different mindset to tackle on this work. But, what I found was that it was enormously challenging, but I was having so much fun doing it. And I realized that, you hit upon a project that you are meant to do when, I mean, if you're having fun and it's easy, then, you know, it's fun, but it's probably not worth doing that much. But if it's really difficult, but at the same time, you're not enjoying it, then it's probably, you are not probably meant to do it. But when it's enormously difficult, but you're having like a great time every step of the way, that's really the right project for you. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed even the most difficult part of this entire task. And, you know, a part of it has to do with my revisiting my childhood hero, you know, and all, a part of it is has to do with describing all this new information as a historian, and getting in touch with sort of the traditional culture that I come from and so on. So that's the origin of this project.
That's awesome. It sounds like it would be as if there was some literary manifestation of David Bowie in Labyrinth that existed out there, and I would just be like devoting my entire post-tenure life to just
writing about
that.
Yeah.
That for me, that would be my Hongildong. But we're not talking about David Bowie here. We're talking about Hongildong. So we can get to, there are a number of really, really fascinating issues that you bring up early on in the book, in the introduction, that we'll talk about in a moment. But before we talk about that, you've already mentioned that this is an extraordinarily popular figure in modern Korea today. And there are a number, and you describe some of these in the book, of really interesting modern manifestations of this story. So what are some of your favorite modern manifestations of this story? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about some of them?
Yes. I could not have been happier with the cover of the Penguin Classic, because the cover was done by a animation artist named a Chinese American animation artist named Sachin Tang, and it's sort of based on a kind of advice that I gave to Penguin about what they should be looking for, which is that there's an iconic image of Hongildong that is instantly recognizable to all Koreans. This sturdy young man dressed in a blue robe and a yellow hat. And that image comes from a 1967 animation movie, which is of Hongildong's story, which is a important film in the history of Korean cinema, because that was the first full-length animation movie that was made in South Korea.
Wow.
It was a huge hit. And it was based on a series of comic books that was made previous to that. And that image has been, I mean, not only was, you know, that image is important and instantly recognizable to all Koreans, not only because the movie was a hit, but man, they used that figure for advertising purposes and all kinds of, I remember like it was selling batteries and, you know, during my childhood in the late 70s, I remember like they were advertising soap where Hongildong was like beating up on germs.
Why not? You know, using yeah. sorcery skills and, you know, I get that.
Yeah. And it was beating up on germs, and then Hongildong will turn into a bar of soap, and they said buy this brand of soap, it'll get rid of germs like Hongildong would get rid of corrupt officials.
Wow, that's
and yeah. So all kinds of advertising and different manifestations and so on. So that animation film was played, came out in the theaters, I was, you know, that was before my time, but it's been repeatedly played on Korean TV. I have a personal fondness for that because of my childhood experience. And I think for most Koreans, they'll remember that figure from that animation very, very fondly. Another really great, modern manifestation that people now can check out is that during the 1980s, there was a North Korean movie of Hongildong that was made that is now available on YouTube. You can watch the entire thing on YouTube.
Wow.
And it is completely interesting because the way in which they got this Joseon Dynasty story and managed in very interesting way to infuse it with modern Juche communist propaganda into the story. And it's also, it, I mean, that's also interesting in one part. Like for instance, one of the famous things about North Korean regime is its extreme xenophobia against Americans, and you know, South Koreans were regarded as just puppets of Americans, and then the Japanese and so on. The last part of the North Korean version of Hongryotong has to do with Japanese ninjas invading Joseon Dynasty.
Wow.
to steal Korean women and treasures. Right?
Whoa.
And Hongryotong and his band of outlaws has to team up with his half brother and Joseon Dynasty soldiers to stop these ninjas from their nefarious deeds. And it's completely interesting. But there's another completely fascinating element to this story that to the movie, which is that you may know this story. I think there's been a couple of books written on it and so on. So Kim Jong Il, not current but the last leader of North Korea, was a huge movie buff, and he wanted to create a North Korean movie industry, but he realized, I mean, they really did not have a proper, you know, know-how in terms of filmmaking. So, I mean, he just got frustrated with the fact that, you know, North Korean films really sucked. So his solution to this was to mobilize the North Korean Secret Service and kidnap South Korea's leading director and actress.
As one does, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, what else are you going to do, right?
Yeah. So Shin Sang-ok, the director Shin Sang-ok, and the actress Choi Eun-hee were invited to this, non-existent East Asian film festival in Hong Kong, and they were both kidnapped and sent to North Korea. And Choi Eun-hee tells the most remarkable story about being drugged and waking up in a hotel room, and she opens up the curtains, and it's downtown Pyongyang. It's like, how did I get here? And the door opens and Kim Jong-il comes in, and the next thing that comes out of his mouth has become the most famous thing that Kim Jong-un has ever said. He says, hello, my name is Kim Jong-il, and I look like a dwarf piece of shit, don't I? So after they were kidnapped, they were forced to make films for the North Korean regime. We know all of this because I don't know how long. I think it's about 10 years. They managed to persuade Kim Jong-il that they were pretty happy being there, and they weren't. And when they were allowed to go to Europe to attend a film festival, they made a beeline for the American embassy and got out of there. Mm-hmm. And their in-depth memoir about the experience in North Korea is still to this day the most detailed description of life in the upper echelons of North Korean society that we have today. Right? How does this relate to Kim?
Hongryotong.
So we don't know whether Shin Sang-ok directly directed Hongryotong or he supervised another North Korean director to direct it, but we know that he was heavily involved, and this was one of the last movies that he was involved in before he managed to escape. Mm. Right. What's interesting to me is that it's basically a martial arts movie. It's basically a North Korean martial art movie. Unlike a lot of other North Korean movies, the North Korean propaganda is definitely there, especially with the ninjas and everything, right? But it's actually pretty light in touch. I mean, it's basically an action movie. That entire complicated story of Shin Sang-ok development and Shin Sang-ok's involvement and how they use the Joseon Dynasty novel and also the presence of North Korean propaganda, that all of that combines to make this a completely fascinating movie in itself to analyze.
Awesome. Yeah. And it's on YouTube.
Yes, the whole thing's available on YouTube.
We'll try to link that for listeners, actually, after this.
Yeah.
So there are a number of common misconceptions about the book, but I think I'm going to bring us there after we dive into the story itself. So for listeners who, you know, they're listening, they're thinking, this sounds like a pretty interesting story and a pretty groovy character, but what the heck did he do? Like, what's the big deal? Let's take them right into it. Okay, so what is the story of Hong Gildong? Well, the structure of the story has three parts of roughly equal length. And you tell us a little bit about this in the early part of the book, but let's actually work our way through and kind of hit some of the highlights and give listeners a sense of why, some of the reasons why this story is so fascinating and really interesting. So the first part of the book is set in the compound of the Hong family. So this is Hong Gildong's Hong, right? This is that Hong. And it offers a what you call a realistic portrayal of life in a nobleman's household. There are wives, there are concubines. They don't always get along. There are legitimate children, there are illegitimate children. And that becomes really, really important. So I'm going to kind of lay the groundwork for listeners. All right. So High Minister Hong has this dream about conceiving a son at the beginning of the story. And he approaches his wife, like this, you know, kind of a like classic booty call, right? I just had a dream. Let's go make superhero boy. Wife says, no, go away. So instead he goes to a servant girl named Chun Som and he conceives Hong Gildong. So Hong Gildong's mom is not the wife. She's a servant girl who then becomes promoted to a concubine. All right. So Gildong is the secondary son of a nobleman. Why, for listeners, right? Why is this fact so interesting and important for us to understand in order to understand like kind of what makes this story really important and interesting in the context of fiction from this period?
Great. One of the sort of ongoing controversy throughout the Joseon Dynasty is laws and opportunities for the secondary children. They're called so'ol, which literally translates as secondary children, which are defined by, you know, children whose fathers are noblemen, but, you know, whose mothers are, you know, either commoners or low-born people, right? In the dynasty before Joseon Dynasty, in the Goryeo Dynasty, polygamy was legal, and so for men who could afford to do so, they had multiple wives and, you know, children from those wives, of course. And when a Goryeo Dynasty man died, every one of his wives and children were eligible to receive a part of the inheritance, right? Joseon Dynasty is founded in the late 14th century and much more Puritan, neo-Confucian society. Legally, only one wife is permitted per man. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the practice of keeping multiple women in a household for, you know, rich and powerful people stops, right? Of course not, right? They continue to bring extra women into the household and they are made into concubines, but they have absolutely no legal standing in society. And so a Joseon Dynasty man dies and only the legitimate wife and her children can receive inheritance and everybody else is left in the lurch. The problem with that is that the secondary children, their numbers grow through the Joseon Dynasty, and they're more or less permanently placed in this kind of in-between limbo position, you know, not you know, nobility and not commoners in the secondary status, which made life for the children especially extremely difficult. As you'll see, one of the sort of ongoing laments of Hong Gildong, right? For those of you who know something about Joseon Dynasty society is that the word for nobility. By the way, there is sort of an ongoing discussion about whether nobility is the right term. The historian Eugene Park has made a good argument that, you know, it's aristocracy will be a better term, right? Because the term for the Korean nobility or aristocracy is yangban, which literally means two directions or two orders. That denotes one of two directions that a young man born into a noble family was supposed to take in order to advance himself in society. One was to take the literary examinations given by the government once every 4 years, you know, an extraordinarily difficult exam examination, which required basically you memorizing all the Confucian classics and mastering, you know, composition skills and so on. You know, it's like even if you're born into a noble family, being a young son in a noble family was no joke, because like as soon as you can start, you know, you can start reading. I mean, you're just like studying all damn day long, right? Because, you know, the fate of the entire family depends on it, right? So if you pass the exam, then you work for the government, and hopefully through promotions, you'll get to a high ranking, hopefully as a minister and so on. That's one way. And the other way is to take the military exams and go on the career as a military officer. Now, at the beginning of the Joseon Dynasty, there was an actual law that prohibited secondary children from taking the examinations, mm-hmm. right? Which meant that, you know, if you're a secondary son in a noble family, you grow up under fairly privileged circumstances, you probably get educated, and your father, your half-brothers, and your relatives are all part of the nobility, but you're not. And at the end of it, because, you know, I mean, your career paths are all blocked, you basically have to depend on your relatives, you know, financially, or you have to do like commoner's work that you might regard as, you know, beneath your station. And this placed them in a very, very difficult situation. And throughout the long 500-year history of the Joseon Dynasty, there were periodic attempts to try to rectify the situation. And there were incremental progress, throughout the, 500-year period. On certain circumstances, if you're like a third generation secondary son, you're allowed to take the examination. But even then, because of prejudice against, you know, your station, your chance of promotion was very, very low. I mean, you're probably going to get stuck at a low level, you know, position in government. And finally, in the 18th century, the great King Yeongjo, who himself was the son of a palace maid, lifted all restrictions towards secondary sons from taking their examinations, and he even explicitly gave permission for them to call their fathers fathers and their their half brothers brothers. But even then, I mean, you know, even if you pass the examination and, you know, go into government, even then, people are not going to promote you, right? So a lot of them would not even bother. And it's really until, very late 19th century. I mean, the pretty much in the last decade of the 19th century, when the whole order of the Joseon Dynasty was falling apart, that you had significant numbers of people from these secondary son backgrounds who started to play a major role in that society. That has to be understood in terms of what Hong Gyeltong is going through, right? Because he's on and on and on, right? He complains to his father, his mother, and the king, right? I have all these talents. I'm so smart and I'm so strong. Yet I can't go this way. I can't go that way. What am I supposed to do, right? Mm-hmm. And he sort of indicts the society in saying, saying that, you know, I was basically driven to, you know, become an outlaw because of my, the lack of my station. Oh, by the way, there's an extraordinary book called Beyond Birth by the historian Kyung Moon Hwang, which tells the story about, the collapse of the Joseon Dynasty order in the late 19th century and the emerging role that people like, people from, you know, secondary status played in that century, and how important they were in establishing modernity in Korea.
Awesome. So listeners, though, may not know that after this point, we get some magic all up mm-hmm. in here, right? So let's mm-hmm. say, all right, so where we are, and thank you so much for explaining that. So we're in this household. There's a dream. There's a son that's born. He's kind of a problem, okay? Mm-hmm. And one of the concubines in particular kind of gets it in for him. and sets up this whole situation, and this is still in the first part of the book, where there's a physiognomist who's brought in, who makes a kind of prophecy about Hongil-dong bringing destruction to the whole family. So sort of in the wake of this, there's this attempt to kill him, right? And so one of the kind of main concubines hires this assassin to take his life, and the assassin comes in, and Gildong, in the words of the book, unleashes his sorcery all over this guy. So in this part of the book, we see a really, really fascinating scene where Gildong basically uses his sorcery, uses his magic to completely thwart this assassination attempt, to take care of the physiognomist and somebody else, and essentially as a result of all this, he kind of comes into his power, and by the end of this section, we see him actually on his way to leaving the compound of the Hong family. And this brings us to kind of the second major part of this story. So the first part of the story is super fascinating. The using magic and sorcery to thwart the assassination attempt is easily, for me, one of the most badass parts of the whole book. But it gets even more so. Okay, so part two. So Gildong leaves his household. He finds a band of outlaws, and he becomes their leader. Now, he does this by demonstrating his worth, by lifting a really heavy rock, and by stealing some stuff from a Buddhist temple. And the whole stealing some stuff thing is very kind of interesting and also involves lots of sorcery and super, super fascinating. This part of the book depicts Gildong as a sort of noble robber, like Robin Hood, in a way that you've alluded to already. Now, this part of the book has been claimed to be particularly politically subversive. But you argue here that the book shows his discontent from an inability to participate in the political order, not a desire to be politically subversive and completely overthrow it. So since this seems to be a kind of interesting way into what's happening here, can you talk about this issue of this part of the book being read as evidence of political subversion? And for you, given, you know, as much as possible, given the kind of texture of and the details of what's happening in the story, why is that not the right way to understand this?
Right. So there's a great deal of complexity to this. And I hope you can, you know, talk more about certain aspects of it. But just to give you a sort of a the entryway into, you know, the complex question of, you know, the story's meaning. The very first modern Korean interpreter of the story of Hongil-dong was a man by the name of Kim Tae-jun, who during the colonial era wrote the first major major book on the history of Joseon Dynasty fiction. And that slim book has become, I mean, unbelievably influential in all future studies of Joseon Dynasty literature, to the extent of many of this book, English, including English language ones, sometimes quote Kim Tae-jun verbatim in terms of a lot of ideas. Right. The problem is that a lot of his ideas are now really seen as problematic at best, if not actually wrong. There's sort of the factual basis of this, but there's also an ideological basis to this, because Kim Tae-jun was a radical nationalist and a committed communist. And so his interpretation of the story of Hongil-dong tended to be one that was very subversive and revolutionary. And he had this notion that the supposed author of the story of Hongil-dong, the 17th century statesman and poet Hogyun, was a kind of a proto-socialist of Joseon Dynasty, who met his end because of a failed attempt to have a kind of a proto-socialist revolution in Joseon Dynasty itself to usher in a more egalitarian society. And the story of the of Hongil-dong as a kind of his literary manifesto of his radical political ideas, right? Well, this is extremely problematic for all kinds of reasons, but because his interpretation had been so influential, it tends to be seen as, so Hong Kyo-dong's activity as an outlaw, it tends to be seen as a series of radical critiques of feudalism, right? Which is exactly how Kim Tae-jun put it, right? Joseon Dynasty, feudalism, its inequities and so on. And Hong Kyo-dong as this sort of, you know, Joseon Dynasty, proto-socialists who want to change society and so on, right? Now, there's a couple of things I want to point out. One is that Hong Kyo-dong always couches his activities as things that he would have liked to have done as a government official, right? Which is to, punish corrupt officials and make sure corrupt people aren't hoarding wealth and so on and so on. There's never a moment when you could point to where he really thought that he wanted to completely radically change the nature of the society. And once he's sort of, forgiven by the king, he's sort of very happy, and he's and once the king grants him an official position in the court, not only does he express unending gratitude to the monarch, he does him a huge favor by leaving Joseon. So he can spare him the embarrassment of having an ex-criminal working in his government, right? Now, the thing is, a lot of the things that, like, Hong Kyo-dong is saying that people have pointed to as evidence of his anti-feudalistic critique, things like there ought to be a proper meritocracy so that people like himself who's from secondary background should not be discriminated against, officials ought to be benevolent and correct in their behavior, and people ought not to hoard wealth and all that. That's not really Marx, that's Confucius. These are Confucian cliches. I mean, pretty much every, intellectual of the Confucian mold just have to give lip service to all these ideas. These are hardly radical ideas, right? I mean, these are sort of the classic sort of, Confucius and Mencius themselves have said stuff like this, right? Meritocracy, benevolence of, people, power holders and so on, right? I want to be, at this point, be very, very careful here, because I was actually asked during a previous interview why I thought that the story of Hong Kyo-dong was inherently conservative. That sort of made me panic, because I said, no.
I would never ask you that. I would never.
Okay. No, of course not. Right? Oh, no. You're too, way too astute a reader to be honest.
Yes, I would never do that. Anyway.
Yeah. But I said that, yeah, but, I can understand why my introduction might have given you that impression that I thought that way, right? For so long, the standard reading of Hong Kyo-dong is that it's a highly, highly subversive work. It's anti-feudalistic. And it's all, people will go so far as to say it's proto-socialistic and so on, right? So I pushed back against it, a bit, in all the ways that I already talked about. But, of course, there are many, many elements that's extremely subversive, right? I mean, especially in a Confucian society, it's a critique of fatherhood, because, Hong Kyo-dong's father is not, he's sort of a failed father. It is a critique of monarchy. And the fact that, it makes a hero out of a lawbreaker, yeah, that's extremely, subversive, because, Confucius would have never said that that's a proper way of, registering, your discontent, right? There are proper ways to do it, which is endless remonstrance and, sending memorials to the king and so on. There are proper ways to, do this and improper ways to do it. And becoming a criminal is, of course, improper. And robbing government offices, these are incredibly subversive. But at the end of the day, what I would like to point out is that getting any complex work of literature and trying to fit it into the two binary categories of conservative or subversive is inherently foolish, right? That any great work of literature, whichever way you want to go, you can find plenty of evidence for both, right? I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like either conservative, but that doesn't give you a holistic way of looking at it. And essentially, like, I mean, like for instance, if you take like, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, right? Is that a conservative novel because it talks about the horrific consequences of adultery, you know, ruining of the family and all of that, and it's a sort of moralistic novel saying that you shouldn't commit adultery, or is it subversive because Anna Karenina is such a, you know, sympathetic figure, and you know, we and we come to like sort of sympathize with her position and all that? Well, those are sort of stupid questions, you know. I mean, it's both, you know. I mean, it's obvious that Tolstoy, you know, did not approve of adultery, but it's also obvious that, you know, Anna is a very sympathetic woman, and that's what makes, you know, the novel so interesting, so endlessly interesting, right? I mean, because it works in their pole. And I'll say the same thing about Hong Gil-dong. Yes, there's lots of subversive element in it, but no, it's not proto-socialistic.
Okay.
it's you know, and it's not anti-feudalistic as such, right? I mean, they're critiques of, you know, of the status quo there, right? And I'm sure we can talk about this, but you know, I mean, the conservative element of it, I think, is shows up nowhere else better than in the last part where he gets to make his own society.
That's right. And so there's this third part, and we won't have a whole lot of time to talk about this, but I want to at least make sure that we go through it a little bit for listeners so that they can know there's a whole lot more magic to come, actually. So the third part of the book, or the next part, follows Hong Gil-dong in a bunch of magical adventures in far-off lands. He builds this series of realms in this part of the book, and you talk here in the book, and we won't have a whole lot of time to talk about it now, but just to kind of signal for listeners who might be particularly interested in this issue, you talk about the ways that these realms have been referred to by some people as utopias, but you urge readers to kind of not necessarily see them in that way, and we can talk about that later if we have time. But there are these series of realms he builds. He constantly changes his form in this part of the book. At one point, he makes 8 fully functional alternate Gil-dongs out of straw. Okay, really, really interesting. He tricks people all the time. At one point, he figures out how to get himself named Minister of War. I think you sort of alluded to this before. He saves 3 women from a pack of monsters that had kidnapped them. He pretends to be a doctor and gives the main monster this medicine that's actually poison. And so he rescues the women. One of them becomes his wife, and the others are so grateful they become his concubines. And I have a note in the margin on this part of the book that says, hubba, hubba. Very worked out very well for Hong Gil-dong. So toward the end of the book, he comes back into contact with his family. All kinds of stuff happens with his brother, and he builds this incredible tomb that ultimately winds up being the place that his parents rest. Okay, so Minsu, to kind of maybe as a way to bring out some of what's happening in this later part of the book for listeners that you feel is particularly interesting, were there any moments here that as a translator, as someone who is actually, you know, a creative writer, insofar as you're translating this work and producing this creative work of your own, were there any moments here that you found particularly interesting that you'd want to point us to and open up a little bit for listeners?
Yeah, the utopian part, I think I find very interesting because the aforementioned Kim Tae-jun, the first interpreter of Hong Gil-dong, he dedicates an entire sub chapter to analyzing Hong Gil-dong, the story of Hong Gil-dong in detail as a subversive anti-feudalistic work, but says very little about that last part. About what happens when he goes to a different country and gets to make a society of his own, of which he becomes a king, right? He calls it the country that he founds it. Kim Tae-jun described it as an ideal land or an ideal country, right? Since then, pretty much every literary descriptions of that section, both in Korean and I found numerous descriptions of this in English language texts as well, constantly describes Hong Gil-dong, the king, his kingdom, as a utopia. Right? And I was under the impression before I read the novel too, read the novel too, but I was sort of appalled that it's nothing of the sort. He basically replicates Joseon Dynasty monarchy in his island with himself as an absolute monarch. Mm-hmm. All the titles that he gives to his people, his generals, his ministers, and so on, are identical to Joseon Dynasty titles. And something that you pointed to before, which I actually found quite appalling, which is that he has these three women. And he marries one of them, and the other two becomes concubine, which means that he has also instituted the Joseon Dynasty law of one woman per man, mm-hmm. which means that there's also going to be secondary children in his kingdom, right? It's almost that he's like completely forgotten his frustrations as a secondary child, right? Now that's going to be replicated in his kingdom as well, right? Where apparently the sons from his concubine are going to be the rulers of the subordinate territory, to the main territory he has in one island, right? And to me, that's so there's description of how happy people are in that kingdom because of the wise, rule of, Hongryeo-dong as a king. But there are very few descriptions of it. And what they are is, if you pay close attention to them, they're just description of an ideal time under an ideal king, right? It's no innovative system of government. There's no mention of any kind of egalitarian, system or elimination of, the caste system and all that, right? I mean, everything is described seems to be just, traditional Korean monarch. And I actually think it's unfair to have expected a Joseon Dynasty writer to come out with a completely radical different vision of the kind of society that he could have constructed, right? And it's just a kingdom. I mean, it's just a regular kind of, dynastic kingdom. And that part, I think, for reasons that I can tell you, I mean, pretty much, I think what's interesting about the status of the story of Hongryeo-dong in modern Korea is that it's a story that everybody knows, but few people have actually read. Right. And I think that part would actually surprise even a lot of Koreans who think that they know the story. Right. Sort of led to believe that the kind of society that he creates at the end when he gets a chance to, be a monarch would be something completely different. And it isn't.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff that we could talk about that's, mm-hmm. Located in the particular storyline. And I'll just say that we won't have time to do a lot of that, but I hope that listeners will actually get their hands on a copy and sit down and read it for themselves, because it's fascinating and it really is a page turner. It really, really is. It's really fun to not just read, but also for listeners who are particularly interested in thinking about this in terms of an assignment for a class. There are lots and lots of different kinds of course syllabi that this would fit really, really beautifully into. Mm-hmm. And it's a short reading. This is a reading that students can easily do in a week. And so this is, I highly, highly recommend that listeners look this up and think about it in terms of a pedagogical material, as well as something that's really just kind of a pleasure to read. But part of that pleasure comes from your particular skill as a translator. And we don't have a whole lot of time, but I would just like to ask you, for listeners out there who are listening to our conversation, who are inspired by your ability to balance and manage the work of a writer, the work of a historian, the work of a translator, and who might be inspired to consider integrating translation projects into their own work. Is mm-hmm. there any advice that you have to other people and colleagues who might think about doing this in terms of really any aspect of the process of balancing all of these things, managing this, and sort of undertaking this craft that you feel notable and worth sharing?
As I said, that part of it was extremely challenging for me because this is languages, the language and mentality that I was not familiar with, and I had to really learn to put myself in. And as you said, the balancing act is really, really important. I mean, it's one thing when you're translating from one European language to another, where there is some similarity to the way the languages work. But when you have such two completely different linguistic systems from Korean to English, and also, you know, pre-modern Korean to English, there's a whole set of difficulties that you wouldn't have in a, you know, in related languages. One of which is that I've always found that the there's always a, I mean, so usually the way to go is that do a that I went about is that first do a very, very literal translation, right? Just almost word by word. And then you can't stop there because a lot of this just comes out as gibberish if it's just too literal, right? And then I have to do a slow process of making it more and more colloquial to make it more, to make it flow better and make it really comprehensible to modern readers. I think one advice that I would like to give is that sometimes you don't want to make it too colloquial. I mean, I think lots of nuances get sacrificed because in the interest of making it sound fluent for modern readers. You know, especially when you're dealing with a completely different culture of a completely different time, I think it's okay when things, some of these things seem alien, the way people are putting it seem alien. And I think it's okay to sometimes leave it the way it is and then explain certain things in the footnotes. Because you do want to give your reader a flavor of what how different it is when you're thinking in a completely different language and so on. The two very brief examples that I could give was one simple one. I really had a dilemma as to how to translate names from Chinese whether I was going to give the Korean way of pronouncing those Chinese names or just, you know, using the pinyin system, you know, do it in the Chinese way. Like, for instance, Confucius. Do I do Kongzi or Kongja, which is the way Koreans would pronounce it? I just decide that I want readers to... I want to replicate for readers as closely as possible what it's like to read it in Korean. So I kept it in the way that Koreans think of it, right? So it's you know, Gongja and Mengja rather than Gongzi and Mengzi, right? And they explained that in the footnote. And the other one is, sort of more obscure proverbs and expressions that I could have, you know, switched to, you used English equivalents. But I just found those fun, you know. There are certain proverbs that are still used today, right? Like the proverb, the bird hears in the day and the rat hears in the night, which means that, be careful what you say because you're likely to be overheard, right? So if you're about to tell me a secret and I see that there are too many people around, I'll say, well, maybe we should go to some place private because you know what they say, bird hears in the day and the rat hears in the night, right? The thing is, I could have translated that the walls have ears, but that's not, I would like to use the Korean proverb and just explain it in a footnote. I mean, that just seems much more closer to it. And also, it was a great challenge because there's certain proverbs that are no longer used today in Korea. So I had to figure it out. Like, for instance, remember when Hong Gil-dong lays siege to this castle and he warns the king of the castle that, if you don't surrender right now, I will take your castle. And then rock and jade will burn alike.
Oh, yes, yes. I do remember that. Yes.
Yeah. And I was like, what does that mean? Rock and jade will burn alike, right? Because that's not used in Korea today, right? So I had to do quite a lot of research and I figured out that it means that all people will be destroyed, whether they are high or low or good or evil, right? So, you know, obviously rock is a common thing and jade is precious and they will all burn alike, right? You know, and there are other expressions like that. They, you know, they are English equivalents, but I honestly don't think it's, you know, it's so difficult because you have to make a judgment call at every point. I mean, do I err on the side of making it colloquial and flow better, or do I err on the side of preserving the original? I think over translating is just as great a translating sin as it is as under translating, where it's just, you know, it's too literal and people just haven't done enough good job of just really looking for the right solution that goes in the midway.
Mm-hmm. So Minsu, we are now nearing the conclusion of our conversation. There's so much more that we could talk about, right? I mean, just the context, the texture of the story. But in the meantime, while listeners are waiting to get their hands on their own copies of the book, is there anything that you'd like to mention for listeners that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to kind of put on the table before we close?
Yeah. So the introduction that I wrote is part of a much longer research, because as I said, when I looked into this, I sort of stepped on a scholar's minefield. And like, for instance, there's a whole question of, you know, the dating, right? The dating of the piece. Why, for instance, you know, because of Kim Tae-jun's interpretation and so on, why most Koreans still today believe that it's a 17th century work by Hogyun. It's a radical work. And why current scholarship, and, you know, based on also my own research, it seems fairly obvious that it's actually not that old, that it's actually probably from the mid 19th century. It's a very complicated story of how the interpretation. But interesting enough, it's also a story about how the problem with the way literature is taught in the Korean school system. It's kind of interesting, you know, because because there's sort of certain ideas about it. The school system in Korea, as in, you know, China and other places, are so much geared toward memorization. It's all geared toward passing the college entrance exams. Instead of having students read the entire work, they read a small section and are given 5 or 6 important facts to memorize, so that they can, you know, pick the right one during the, you know, absolutely crucial, you know, multiple choice questions that they get as part of the examination, which are going to determine the rest of their lives, right? So they're given like a tiny sections of the story and asked to memorize. You know, I mean, it's written by Hogyun, subversive work that's anti, you know, feudalism and so on and so on. And as a result, most Koreans don't ever get the chance to like read the entire thing. So we have this kind of weird situation where the story is so famous and everybody thinks that they know the story, but very few people have actually read it. It just sort of reminds me of a bunch of years ago. I saw this like travel documentary where this film crew went to the town of La Mancha in Spain. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, that entire town, much of its economy is based on Don Quixote tourism. Mm-hmm. And there's Don Quixote stuff everywhere, statues and all that, right? And at some point, the film crew started asking, you know, townspeople, so when was the last time you read Don Quixote, right? And there's, oh, I actually haven't read it, right? And they couldn't find a single person who've actually read the novel, right? And one of the reasons for that is that, you know, it's too familiar to them. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, they know the story, right? They think they do, right? I mean, the, you know, tilting at the windmill and all of that, right? And we have a very similar situation in Korea. Everybody in Korea can recite Hong Gil-dong's Lamentation. I cannot even address my father as father and my older brother as brother, right? I mean, everybody can recite that. And people are probably are not reading the book because they think they know the story already. And all of these are sort of very fascinating story that I realized that I had to write an entire book on. So the manuscript is done, and I'm in the process of looking for a good university press to place it with. And I think along with the translation, people will get the full story that I managed to do a very short description of in the introduction.
Great. Well, best of luck with that project.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking time away from that to talk with me today. It's really been a pleasure, and congratulations on an awesome translation.
Dick, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.